Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to this event in this lovely new lecture theatre. My name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies in the University and Fellow of Woolston College. It's a real pleasure to welcome you to this event and particularly to welcome our speakers, whom I will introduce in a moment. So today's event is sponsored by three organisations. First of all, Woolston College, where we are placed, but also the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is a freestanding independent institute that's associated with Woolston and with the university. And thirdly, the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, which is a research institute in the university. These three institutions come together in Woolston to form a research cluster, as we like to call them, which means we try to raise the interest in questions of law, justice and society, very broadly construed, and in order to encourage people from different disciplines and different interests to come together on occasions such as this to talk about issues of law, justice and society, or any one or two or three of those, not necessarily all three at once. So tonight's event is really the inaugural event of a new program called Development and the Implications for Law, Justice and Society. And so this is the beginning of a program of activities, workshops, discussions, and we hope perhaps research into some of the really important issues of development and the implications that that has for questions of law, questions of justice and questions of society. So it's very nice to be able to launch a new program. Now, I just want to introduce then our three speakers. First of all, we have Masuda Bano, known to many of you, a familiar face around both Woolston College and the university. Masuda is well known for her interest in studying the role of ideas and beliefs in development processes and their evolution and change. She builds large-scale comparative studies combining ethnographic and survey details. Her current project explores the emergence and growth of female Islamic education movements across the Muslim world in recent years. And this draws on extensive fieldwork in a number of countries, Pakistan, Nigeria, and Syria. Whether she goes to Syria just at the moment is a question we might pose for her later. Masuda is a fellow of Woolston College and a lecturer in the Department of International Development. And so it's a real pleasure to have her present and to welcome her to this panel. Next is our another guest from outside Oxford, Michael Woolcock, whose lecture in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's the lead social development specialist with the World Bank in its development research group in Washington, D.C. His current work focuses on interactions between customary and state legal systems, conducted as part of the World Bank's Global Justice for the Poor program, for which he is partly co-founder, and for strategies for assessing complex social interventions. He has written many books, like Masuda, both very prolific authors in a range of areas. I should also say Michael is an Australian. He has an MA and a PhD in sociology from Brown University. He has taught at Harvard, as I mentioned. He's taught at various other institutions around the world, including University of Manchester, where he was Professor of Social Science and Development Policy. So Michael, it's a real pleasure to, an honour to welcome you to this occasion. And last but not least is our own Sam Clark, who is a doctoral student here in the college and a member of the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, where he is just bringing his doctorate to a climax, we hope. His research project focuses on the investigation and prosecution of subnational corruption I think he means local corruption, in democratic Indonesia. Sam is an expert on Indonesian affairs. Prior to coming to Oxford, he spent 5 years working in the social development unit of the World Bank, and his work there focused on conflict management, post-conflict integration, community development, and local government in various areas in Indonesia. He continues to consult for the World Bank on judicial reform, on legal empowerment, and community development in the Asia-Pacific region. Like Michael, he comes from the Antipodes, where he has a Master's of Public and International Law from University of Melbourne, and a Bachelor of Commerce from the University of Melbourne as well. So we have a very distinguished panel of speakers. Unfortunately, I've limited them to 20 minutes each, so they will present rather compressed, but I'm sure focused and to the point, presentations on this matter. After we've heard the three presentations, we will have about half an hour or so for open discussion. So we'll go through the three and then finalise with some open questions and comments. So on that note, I'm going to invite Michael to speak first. Over to you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Dennis, who also comes from Australia, by the way. to you for overseeing today's events, and for Sam in particular for inviting me to be part of this. It's great to work with people in very different contexts over many years, and to see Sam here at Oxford when we first met him in 2004 in Jakarta is a very different person, a very different place in life. So it's one of the gratifying parts of getting older is that you get to be part of people's professional development through this very key part of their life. I'm going to talk a bit about the post-2015 development goals. I'm going to give you a sense of, at least very briefly, where they came from, and focus in particular on the new initiatives that are, or the new issues that are part of this agenda, particularly those they pertain to justice and governance, and give you a sense of my, I wouldn't say half full, half empty, I'd say two-thirds skeptical, maybe a little bit optimistic way in which one can read these developments, and what those of us that ultimately care about justice and governance and are trying to instantiate very different policy responses to those problems can take can contribute to these new ways of measuring and presenting the problems to the rest of the world. Just very briefly, as Dennis mentioned, I helped set up the global program called Justice for the Poor. Two of our colleagues, not me, have been very actively involved by virtue of being part of our program in the attempts by the United Nations to try and come up with these new indices. So we've been, our team collectively has been part of this process, and I'm shamelessly drawing on their lived experiences of trying to have these conversations as part of what I'm going to talk about today here. But my broader concern with these issues is really how one comes up with both good theory, good data, and good policy and some strategies for trying to turn broad agreements on the importance of these issues into things that are supportable and implementable by domestic governments. So where this is coming from, as many of you know, just in case you're not fully versed in development speak, in the year 2000, the global community, through the United Nations, set up these eight different goals called the Millennium Development Goals, and they're on the screen in front of you. They were relatively simple, as you can see, and were also drawing on various different indices for which either the UN itself, the World Bank, or some other international agencies had a long-standing or at least fairly comprehensive data sets available to them to be able to track them. So the beauty was their simplicity. Well, that was also a vice in certain ways, but nonetheless, they were taking what we already had, essentially, framing them then as aspirational statements towards which the international community would strive over the period 2000 to 2015. So have we met them? Well, you can. There's any number of different websites that will try and track this for you now. The Millennium Development Goals themselves are largely sort of told to have been met in many countries for many different subgroups, but with important exceptions. And as you can see from the left-hand graph there, which is looking at the proportions of people living on $1.25 a day, which is even itself an extraordinarily low level of poverty. The yellow line basically sort of gives you the sense of what the aspiration was. The goal was to halve poverty and hunger between that over that 15-year period. And even with this data, which was from 2005, it was pretty close to being collected, and you can be fairly sure that the spin machines will be trumpeting that we basically achieved these kinds of goals for the world as a whole. But the devil's in the details, of course, and for particular countries, for particular regions, for particular subgroups within each of these countries, there are lots of non-progress or even stagnation and decline in certain areas. But nonetheless, as a rhetorical device, as a way of trying to educate the world as a whole about what we care about, what we're trying ultimately to do through international development work, I think in a broad sense they've been useful in that regard. They don't really map, of course, onto any obvious agency or organization that can be notionally or actually held accountable, as it were, for whether we have or have not achieved these things. But you know, I think that's in some sense a bit, you can be too churlish in these kinds of critiques. I think as broad aspirational statements about what the world at that time thought was achievable and desirable, I think those kinds of targets serve their place. You have to have been to one of the meetings where these things to get discussed to have a really visceral sense of how difficult even it was to get those eight. I was a few years ago in a meeting in Brussels when a group was being asked to consider the post-2015 agenda, and there was one person who had been at the centre of leading this initial MDG discussion. He just sat there the whole time with his arms folded as every interest group you could imagine was making a case for why they should be on the list for the post-2015 agenda, and just sort of shaking his head every time, just going, you have no idea how hard it was to get 187 countries to agree that even these simple, relatively non-controversial goals should be the ones that we should set. And I think that sort of wisdom from the people that actually whose job it is to turn aspiration and broad consensus into targets and to things that towards we should aspire should be taken pretty seriously, a point that I'll come back to shortly. So there's various different ways you can examine all of this. I don't want to do that in my talks here today. Just some other stuff on gender equality, primary education. At one level, you can tell very positive stories. And now, whether the goals themselves were causally responsible for this, another thing that methodologists can have a field day on, trying to disentangle sort of cause from effect and from other confounding variables that may have been going on. The more serious critique that one makes of things like primary education is that this was an enrollment goal. Large numbers of our children to be enrolled in schools, right? Well, that's something that's good at one level, but what we really care about, of course, is educating kids and kids learning things. And so getting butts on seats, essentially, which was the goal, may or may not be the same thing, or usually isn't the same thing, as I think most recent research is showing, from whether and how kids actually learn stuff. So that, as we'll see shortly, this has been one of the positive refinements of the post-2015 agenda is to move incrementally, not always, but from these things that we would desire in principle to actually focusing more specifically on creating aspirational targets around what we really care about in the case of education, which is learning as opposed to just enrolling. So where to next? Well, as the stories and the evidence and the policy narratives have evolved over this period, the clock has been ticking, and so the more inevitable, really, challenge has been to figure out, well, what do we do next, or where do we go next? What do we want to try and achieve? And you may or may not, you can't read, that's not the point. If you want to read the details on the eminent persons or the high-level persons report that was just published a few months ago, you'll see now that we're up to 12 different indicators for what will be in the post-2015 space, which, as I said, you can't read it, but probably the most common word in all of those 12 is the word "and," which essentially means they've collapsed a whole bunch of things into 12 categories because 8 would be too small and 16 would be too many. So we've ended up with 12 because that's sort of a round number, but you can see on the graph on the right, just the orange line on the bottom is where someone's just counted the number of words and discussion that has gone around each of these indicators. There's been like a tenfold increase in some of these things just by the virtue of the words now that are being used that are required to accommodate all these new issues that people are wanting to put on the table. So, as I said, I think the virtue of the initial goals was their simplicity, was their mapping onto a set of data that we already had that was traceable and trackable over time and then disaggregatable for each country and for groups within each of these countries. I don't say we quite have a laundry list now, but we certainly have a vastly expanded set of goals that will now constitute the 2015 agenda. And for present purposes, I'm going to focus on numbers 11 and 12. Sorry, numbers 10 and 11. Number 10 is to ensure good governance and effective institutions. And number 11 is ensure stable and peaceful societies. Now, those weren't at all on the original MDGs. So these are the fact their presence on these reflects both, I guess, a shift in the way in which the international community is starting to frame these issues, but also I think moral and strategic imperatives that recognize that these issues are crucial for everyone in a global world. Now the politics of this is that you currently have six different UN groups alone trying to get their particular indicators be the ones that become the actual targets, the indicators that are used. This is a live debate. This is not yet determined. I managed to procure some of the information from my colleagues that are actually involved in these discussions, so I can't be too specific about it, but the broader point is that there's still a lot of discussion to be had and a lot of endless seminaring and discussion and negotiation at the UN around which of these many different indicators that we have might start to be used. Now, again, you know, there's a lot to be happy about in some sense. You know, who is against good governance? Who would not want to live in a country with effective institutions? Who doesn't want to live in a stable and peaceful society? No one's against that in the aggregate. All the challenge occurs in moving from broad aspirational statements into concrete indicators. This is hard enough in education. I'm going to argue briefly that it's even more problematic, and deeply problematic, in fact, when one tries to do this in the realm of law and justice and political institutions. So, at the moment, we have various different indicators that are being proposed under six different categories: justice services, legal identity, violence reduction, accountability, property and local issues, and another generic other category. So under this, under the category of justice services, what people are proposing is that we collect a range of indicators on the quality, on access to dispute resolution, caseload reductions. I think the one I'm most happy with actually is the one around legal identity, around whether people have universal ID cards and birth registrations. Most people on the planet today still don't have any way of proving who they are as people. Violence reduction is what I'll come back to, but it's, again, deeply problematic. Even though, again, aspirationally, no one's against, everyone is for, I should say, reducing violence, but how one would actually track this over time is very, very hard. So these are the kinds of discussions that are going on, as every constituent interest group that cares about one of these issues is desperately trying to convince others that, in fact, yes, this should be one of the universal metrics that we hold ourselves notionally to account in the post-2015 period regarding whether we're going to achieve them or not. So why am I sort of sounding a bit skeptical about this? Well, five different reasons. One is that, as I indicated before, that the MDGs were relatively sere and simple, and that we had data already available for most of these. That is just not true of the current round. We're going to have to actually have a lot of investment be made in collecting a lot of this data if we want to truly be able to track it at a global level. I also think more isn't necessarily better. I mean, one can obviously see why every particular interest group would want to have their issue hitched onto the wagon that is being used to talk about these things, but if a key virtue of the initial goals was that they were providing an important legitimizing and public relations and convening role, right, that can very easily descend in just to confusion and to a round of clamoring where we don't actually see a political social movements being and coherent political force being able to be harnessed in the service of meeting these goals, especially in the countries themselves. The biggest and more academic kind of concern, I think, is that most of the change that we're talking about in the sphere of politics and law and justice, the evidence around these things is never self-evident. The evidence itself doesn't tell you what you should do about any of these things. It doesn't provide a basis for policy action. And so, one of my favorite quotes from Gordon Brown is that the hardest part about building the rule of law is the first 500 years. And if that's the kind of time frame you're on when you're talking about building good institutions and building legal systems, you can't indicate your way to a 500-year process in 5 or 15 years or anything like that. So the notion that sort of indicators in and of themselves provide the basis for action seems to me just minimally plausible in some areas, like immunizing babies, for example. But how one would actually leverage that in the space of trying to reduce violence or trying to create effective legal systems and design better constitutions, we just don't have any of that. So that's my deep concern, is that the rush to be seen as part of the new consensus will actually just will collapse on itself just because it doesn't have a corresponding basis in theory. Aggregating all of these justice metrics is enormously problematic. In our work that Sam and I were involved in Indonesia, where we're trying to look at the incidence of local conflict in one country, it was enormously difficult to be able to just find any plausible indicators of that, and then having got them to add them up into something that would constitute a database. What is violence for some groups is not violence for others. It's just deeply context-specific how these issues get rendered and whether and how governments are even willing to divulge that kind of information for public purposes. Most governments have signed up to some broader agreements around childhood immunization or infant mortality from the World Health Organization. We don't have anything like that will bound governments to be giving up ultimately what is very sensitive information about the incidence of crime and their effectiveness in being able to respond to that. So it's just rife with deep problems that are context specific, but that only get worse when you try to add them all up. The final point there is that just even doing any form of data collection requires the kinds of organizations that we wish we actually have and don't have. I thoroughly recommend to you Morton Jervin's book, Poor Numbers, which is an anthropological account of how even the most rudimentary economic data, GDP per capita, the basis for which all the major economic decisions are made in countries around the world, turns out to be a sausage-making machine. The more you know about it, the less you want to go anywhere near this kind of data, because even the one issue around which we all agree we should be collecting information is itself deeply problematic. So if it's not that great in the key issues that we want, that we've all been collecting for many decades, imagining that somehow we can generate squeaky clean, disaggregatable data that can be in turn aggregated across countries into big metrics that we can produce nice little graphs that I had before, only exists in some UN official's mind or fantasy world. It's just not a world where anyone who actually worries about data for a living imagines could really happen. That pessimism, I should say, but I'll conclude just so why I'm a little bit hopeful, why there are some reasons to be cheerful, to invoke Ian Jury. because I think any serious high-level discussion about justice and governance is itself progress. The fact that I'm here talking about this, that many of you have shown up tonight to talk about these things, we weren't having these kinds of discussions a decade ago. Certainly not 2 decades ago. And so whether the cause and effect is going in one direction or another is an open issue. I think the fact that these issues are being discussed at a high level internationally represents itself, I think, a broader evolving consensus that these issues matter. So that in itself is a good thing. I think the particular salience of these issues for fragile states, for the new countries like South Sudan, for the very most fragile countries like Syria and Somalia, we notionally even care about these issues and are willing to put ourselves on public record as being concerned about this is itself important. even though I think there is still, as I mentioned before, a huge gap between our notional consensus and an agreement on the importance of these issues and the absence, really, of either a track record or even a plausible theory for how one actually, or anyone, domestic and or foreign actors, goes into a country like South Sudan and really helps to construct this thing called the rule of law or this thing called good governance. To do that, I think we're actually really going to need an entirely different aid architecture. And again, so I'm in supportive of these developments around these new kinds of goals, because I think they will legitimize that the second round of discussion around the fact that the aid architecture that we have is essentially a relic of high modernism in the Cold War in the mid-20th century. I don't think the kinds of challenges, the kinds of technologies, the kinds of sensibilities that we have available to us now are being adequately channeled in and through the aid architecture that we have. So the work that I've been doing with my Harvard colleagues, Matt Andrews and Lance Pritchett, is very much at the center, we hope, of trying to reframe that. In a more complete statement, I would recommend to you Ben Ramalingam's new book, Aid at the Edge of Chaos, which I think is very much trying to make a case, very powerful and compelling scientific case for engaging with the sciences, the natural sciences, the social sciences, around how we might think about a very different kind of aid architecture. And to the extent that fretting about these things called governance and worrying about whether we can actually do any of this stuff helps in turn to legitimize that second round of conversation, I think it's I'm hopeful that's all part of that. But at the end of the day, as I often tell my Kennedy School students, to invoke a marketing campaign, smart critiques, stupid creates, which is to say, it's easy to critique, right? It's very easy to, especially at a place like Oxford or Harvard, to come up with any number of reasons why these are dumb ideas or why this is not going to work. Da, da, da. We're paid to be critical, right? The harder stuff is like when I was invoking my UN official before, it's just really hard even to get 8 indicators that, like infant mortality, that surely everybody is in agreement that we should be trying to lower that. It's hard enough to get 187 countries to agree that they will actually sign on to a piece of paper committing themselves to that. It's even harder to get them all to agree to collect data on it. So as difficult as these are, my hope is that we will not just be critics, that we will not just be seeing ourselves as sort of armchair skeptics of this kind of work, that we will join with many other people who've really tried to envision and then enact a very different modality of engaging with these issues. And if these kinds of new goals, in their own unintended way perhaps, help legitimize those kinds of conversations, then they will have done, for me, work that justifies a lot of my, or overrides to some extent, some of my earlier skepticism. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael, for that splendid beginning to this panel discussion. So we'll go straight to our second speaker, Masuda.
Thanks, James, for the introductions. And I think I'll just now, Michael has given a very good introduction to the post-2015 targets that are being set, that are to sort of carry on from the Millennium Development Goals, and how they have been broadened, and the governance and good governance agenda is coming more explicitly within it. I think I like now to broaden the debate a bit and look at what Michael has indirectly already referred to as the aid architecture, because that's where my work is, and that's what I'll be sharing a bit with you today. Because when we talk about Millennium Development Goals or any sort of next generation targets we are setting, they're very reliant on how effective is aid. So setting new targets mean nothing if your aid delivery system beyond a point doesn't change or adapt to the changing requirements of the time. And over here, I'll just give an account of where, in terms of aid effectiveness, we stand today. Because aid over the years has been challenged to two main channels. One is the state, the historical channel, post-colonial period. Aid starts from the West, starts going to the developing world. But a lot of challenges are faced in terms of corruption, money not being used for the purposes it is given, inefficient sort of delivery systems, and aid not reaching its target. From 1980 onwards, what we saw was that aid was increasingly channeled through non-state actors, NGOs. That's where my work is, and that's what I'll be presenting more in detail. And the shift was And was justified for two main reasons. One was that aid was NGOs were seen to be more effective than the state. The argument was, you know, we had enough of these corrupt governments in developing third world. So NGOs, these non-state actors, are more committed. They are, you know, voluntary. They're more efficient. They're innovative. So they'll just deliver better in terms of all social services, health, education, whatever the targets. But also linked to it gradually, that's 1980s. Gradually by 1990s was a sort of a broader agenda to it, which was directly linked to what you can call good governance agenda. Because at that time, NGOs were presented by the donors, not just now as a means to an end. Because remember, 1980s is more their means to an end, because they are good because they deliver good services, maybe better than the state. But by 1990s, a lot of social capital argument had come in. We can discuss it later if you're interested, but especially with Robert Putnam's work, the whole idea that social cohesion, communities coming together, working together, is good for governance in itself, had become quite popular. And also, donors use quite a bit of this Tocquevillian notion of civil society, which is very much about societies, individuals coming together, forming membership structures, which is good for producing the good they're producing, but also for good governance, because participation, that builds skills for participation and good governance and delivery. Now, what, of course, we have had, and there's a lot of work on it, so I feel like I'm just repeating very basics, but I'm assuming it's a very big mixed audience, so that's why I'm giving you a bit of history, is that by now we know enough that these expectations for from NGOs did not deliver. Estimates, our data show that almost 30% of overseas development assistance by early 2000s was going through NGOs, you know, which is quite a reasonable amount. But all the increasing evidence we have raises a lot of questions about how effective that aid is, both in terms of its good governance agenda, in terms of participation, building democracy, all of that, as well as in terms of improving service delivery. And my personal argument, I mean, what Sam had asked me to present when he had asked me to participate in the panel, was a specific work, one of my books, that looks at how aid impacts membership structures in developing countries. Because a lot of aid right now is being channeled, like when it goes to the NGOs, it goes for this community-based participatory projects. And over there, what I, for example, in my work in Pakistan have shown is that aid ends up not only, rather than improving social service delivery or generating a participatory structure, it ends up actually having a very negative impact. Because in one survey where I was looking at organizations, NGOs, which were drawing on donor money, and those which are sort of local participatory organizations, there was a marked difference in terms of the ability to mobilize members, local membership members, the ability to raise funds locally. So the NGOs which were reliant on donor money had literally no members, like 1 or 2%. That's what we're talking about. While the local counterparts, which are relying on local money, had very active membership structures, had a lot of sort of local ability to fundraise, which NGOs completely lacked. And interestingly, I also give you evidence that in terms of delivery of that of particular social services, these voluntary organizations were better because they were more sustainable. Donor-funded NGOs were constantly shifting from one project to another, so as a result, there was hardly any long-term contact with the beneficiaries, and work often finished much before the targets could be reached. So that was one aspect of it, that NGOs were, like, drawing on donor money, were failing to sort of have any that kind of sustainable development structures. But what was more interesting, I like to argue, in that research was that I also in that book give you examples where, in fact, groups which were very effectively very well together before there was any donor money in delivery of different kind of social services, collapsed when they started receiving donor money. So, you know, so it's the before and after effect. And I think that was even more interesting, because what you see is that one thing is that, because for the first case I explained to you, it could be one argument is that, or maybe donor money attracts certain profile of people, you know, people who can write reports in English, because that's all donors can deal with. They cannot, you know, they don't know the local languages. So, you know, there's a certain kind of people that donor money can attract. So, you know, it doesn't really get the genuine embedded social groups to work with it. But the other one is that where the people were working together, when money comes in, you know, when donor money comes in, why do we see a reversal of behavior, and why do those groups break down after receiving donor money? Because I had cases, I have cases in that book where groups which are working well together, by the time I was doing field work, were fighting cases in court against each other. You know, they had broken down into factions, and there were corruption cases against each other that they were fighting in courts. So why does that happen? I'll give you a bit of my theoretical take on it, and then come back to the development goals and the implication it has for the future planning, which is this, that often, if you look at it, a lot of voluntary participatory development work that happens, it happens because people are driven by some kind of ideological commitment. It could be either religious, you know, people are very religiously in a country like Pakistan. Often the motivation for getting engaged in these participatory structure is some kind of religious incentive, you know, because they have some kind of religious reward promised for that activity. In Islam in particular, for example, there's a lot of emphasis placed on giving, on sharing, on these participatory kind of systems. So there are different kind of incentives people have for participation in these activities. When donor money comes in, it often comes with very strong material incentives. So it allows for very big salaries for these staff of NGOs. It has very big offices. You know, so it's a very conference-driven culture, per diems. It's a lot of money thrown into that sector. So suddenly it leads to what in psychology and all in economics it's used quite a bit, is called a crowding out effect. So because the people who are very ideologically committed, once you start giving them a lot of material incentive, what we see often over time repeatedly is this, what are called psychosocial rewards, get quite easily crowded out when the strong material incentives come in. So there's been a lot of crowding out effect that we have seen in many contexts with aid coming in. So this is just to give you one very specific example to show how there are a lot of challenges with aid when aid comes in. So how can development partners, and this is just one example, this is the NGO sector. When the remaining 70% of money still goes through some kind of state institutions. And of course, we have many different attempts to improve it, the Paris Declaration, which is trying to align donors better. Some donors now try to sort of direct budget support for the last 10, 15 years has been tried by many donors, where they start putting money directly into state funds. But of course, I'm not going to cover that because that's not my primary research, but that is equally problematic. So with the result today that a lot of the debate on aid effectiveness right now is on two sides. One group which would say stop aid because it's actually negative. Yeah. And the other one which says that no, fine, we realize the challenges, but still we can do something with it. So let's try to improve it. I think personally, I've jumped from the position where I was in the beginning, that it's just bad and we need to stop it because it actually leads to negative impact. And I'd also personally seen it. I come from Pakistan, so before I did my DEEF, I wrote this book, I'd personally seen the challenges it poses too. But with time, I've changed my position, and I think I sit in the middle now, which is this, or the other camp, because I think both camps realize the challenges. It's just that one is a bit more optimistic, just like I guess Michael is also saying, that we realize the challenges, but one is a bit more optimistic. And I think the reason I've also shifted a bit is that I have over time also engaged a bit more with development agencies. With DFID, I've had a long-term partnership now for almost 6 years with a project that I advise on in Northern Nigeria. And what I've tried, what I've learned over time, and I like to argue, is that there are ways to improve the delivery of aid. It can never be perfect, I would like to, I would say. And there are very sort of, and I'll explain reasons for that, because I think there's something very fundamentally problematic with aid delivery system. One is the donor timelines. We have been talking about it for decades now, we all know that. But still, donors are pushed by certain kind of disbursement targets. Certain money has to be disbursed in 3 years, 2 year cycle, or you know, maximum maybe 4 year cycles. So that puts a lot of pressure on the receiving end. So the country offices have a lot of pressure to just disperse, come up with innovative ideas, disperse money irrespective of what long-term impact that might have. So there are a lot of sort of inbuilt challenges. I've just come back, I was in Cambodia, and actually it was linked slightly to a UNICEF study. And again, it's surprising how years after year we keep seeing the same thing and the same challenges are there. Because the field office is very pushed by the short-term targets set by the disbursement agenda, because the donor can only give money for 3 years. And within that, quite unrealistic targets are set, which would be very difficult to meet. So of course, there are some very inherently inherent challenges in the system. But despite that, I would like to argue that there are ways that the system can be improved, because one reason that I've shifted from this position where I used to say that maybe it is all negative and aid should stop, because the bigger argument being that in a way it relaxes the governments, you know, so that this whole idea of a contract between the government and the tax-paying citizen, aid actually breaks that relationship, because a large influx of money makes, say again, the Pakistani government very comfortable, because they've been getting this influx because of the security concern in Pakistan, or countries like Nigeria, where, you know, if they were entirely reliant on the taxes to survive, they might be more effective, you know. So given all these arguments, despite that, the reason what I'm saying, I've shifted now more to an argument where, it needs to continue, but we need to make more effective efforts to improve aid delivery. It's just that, after all, the need in that part of the world is a bit too stark. So additional resources for sure can help, and I think the aid needs to continue. But a few suggestions that I'll leave on the table, and then we can discuss them, which I think might help, is that, first of all, I do think that projects which I've seen over time now being a bit more successful in delivering the promised targets are slightly more longer term in nature. So even this like different intervention that I explained, that I mentioned, it was from the beginning a 6-year education sector plan, which later on has been sort of extended for another 2 years. So I think that kind of longer time period allows for maybe a slightly more better embedding of the projects there. Secondly, I think linked to my own sort of research that I explained earlier, I think the kind of incentives that donors give need to change quite dramatically. And that again is very difficult for the donor to do, and I'll explain why. The reason donors give a lot of high salaries to these NGOs or big cars, per diems to government officials to participate in conferences and all, is that it's easier to dictate your terms if you're paying money. If you go to a genuine voluntary organization, which developing world is full of, the problem is they don't listen to you. They don't take your orders because those are led by leaders who, you know, are ideologically driven, religiously driven. So they come with their own agenda. So if you give them salary, over time they get used to that comfort. They might give up their ideology, at least for that particular project. You know, they might do the religious activity somewhere else, but for that project they might be willing to give it up. I've seen that evidence. But in return, you dictate your terms. But as a term, it becomes a profession for them. It's not a commitment anymore. So for the donor, the problem is that, and they realize that repeatedly. People like us have engaged and briefed with the donors, and I realize a lot of staff in these agencies are pretty sharp people. They realize these challenges. But the challenge is that they come with their head office, a planned program. It has to be delivered this way. If you don't, and also it throws in this whole issue of what is development. Because when you start dealing with different cultures, different voluntary groups, not all of them might buy your Millennium Development Goals exactly 100%, however neutral you might make them. So it's also a lot of agenda setting, priority setting. And over there, I think partnerships can only genuinely evolve. Development language has now moved a lot towards partnerships. But I think those partnerships can genuinely only evolve if the West, which is the leading partner in development debates, is genuinely open to even negotiating what development, you know, is for a given society. Of course, education, health, there can be certain things, maybe there is a consensus across cultures, but there are a lot of nuances within that, and how you implement them can be negotiated better if you are a bit more open to engaging more genuinely, rather than dictating your terms by simply handing out cash. Because you give money, you dictate your terms, but as we repeatedly see, it doesn't have much sustainability. That kind of development doesn't lead very far. So I think I'll close right, with that, okay. And we can have more time for questions, right. Really.
Thank you very much, Masuda. So there's plenty to come back there to discuss. So our third speaker is Sam. Over to you.
Thanks, Dennis. Yes, thank you. Might as well do this now. Sorry. Okay. So, in contrast, I guess, to Michael Masuda's excellent sort of overall presentations that focuses on the aid architecture in general, I'm just going to sort of focus on two priorities that have been identified in the high-level panel's report that was published in May, specifically focused on corruption. And just use some of my research on corruption law enforcement in Indonesia and the efforts in Indonesia to address corruption in the past decade illustrate perhaps whether or not a sort of MDG type approach is the right way to deal with these kind of governance type reforms. So I guess we could sort of maybe see my presentation as a bit of a case study, focusing on one indicator. So as I'm sure most of you are aware, the high level panel, which is set up to advise on the MDG goals. After 2015, or after the MDG goals expire rather, submitted its report in May, and as Michael mentioned, it had 12 goals and 54 targets in an extensive annex. Amongst these, one of them reads is to reduce bribery and corruption and ensure officials can be held accountable. Another reads enhance the capacity of professionalism and accountability of the security forces. And these relate to the goals of ensuring good governance, and ensuring stable and peaceful societies. So Indonesia is a sort of an ideal candidate to sort of look at how one might go about achieving this goal, particularly the goal of reducing corruption. Because it has made a concerted effort to tackle corruption in the past decade since the fall of Suharto. And specifically, I'm going to try and just sketch a picture of two institutions in Indonesia that have focused on corruption law enforcement, which generally is a kind of a key aspect. It's not the only way, of course, of controlling corruption, but it's one of the key, an important way of doing that. So I'm going to focus on the Corruption Eradication Commission and also the Standard Criminal Justice System. Both of these systems have the authority to investigate and prosecute corruption in Indonesia, but they highlight very different ways in which this has been achieved, which I think is useful and sort of perhaps draws attention to the limitations of an approach that is very focused on sort of indicators and I guess also perhaps the limitations of a sort of global sort of MDG type framework. So if we have a look at this graph here, which shows you the number of corruption cases prosecuted in the last 10 years. And what's kind of interesting, and what I want you to sort of imagine, and I know it's a little bit unrealistic, but just imagine that this is an indicator of corruption, of whether or not corrupt progress is being made on corruption. I'm not saying that this is should be an indicator, and I don't think it's been considered in some at the moment. But if you were to look at this, what would you conclude? I mean, you'd probably conclude that the institution that's delivering these, up to, currently 1,000 cases a year, is obviously making much more of an effort, and has been far more active in addressing corruption. Okay, maybe. But what I'm going to try and do is talk a little bit about these two institutions and these two numbers, and talk about how they achieve these outcomes. So let me jump to that. I don't really have any more slides, so I'll just leave that one up there.
What's the green bar? Well,
I'm going to get to that. Yeah, I'm going to get to that now. But they're the two institutions, sorry. So you'd assume that the one that represents the orange institution would be achieving a lot more, and there's a little green one, which I hope you can see down the bottom. So it turns out that the green bar is the Corruption Eradication Commission that was established in... established in 2002, although it didn't really begin any prosecutions until 2004. On average, it prosecutes about 70 cases per year. It's a relatively small number, but the cases that they prosecute tend to involve serious offenders. They're very high-profile cases, national-level cases and the occasional local case. On average, the corruption involved in the cases they prosecute is around $300,000, and some of them are much bigger than that, and then some are smaller. The people they've prosecuted included senior bureaucrats, ministers of the president's current president's party. The chief justice of the Constitutional Court was just accepted. It was just caught by them and arrested 2 weeks ago, red-handed, receiving a $300,000 bribe in relation to two local election cases from Indonesian Borneo and Banten. So, in contrast, the state prosecution service, which consists of the police and the sort of the Attorney General's office, is the orange bar, and they prosecute around, well, it's risen from around 500 cases in the early noughties to 1,400 cases. However, the cases they prosecute are much smaller. The average losses tend to be about $10,000. There's a lot of very junior bureaucrats, village heads. And so if you start to look at what these cases actually are, you start to get a bit of different picture about the relative success of these institutions. I think once you then start to understand how these institutions operate, you also start to get an even more nuanced picture of corruption law enforcement in Indonesia. So let me just talk a little bit more about that, starting with the KPK. So the KPK was established through a combination, or the impetus for the establishment of the KPK was a combination of sort of local activists in Indonesia who had long desired a strong anti-corruption agency after various failed attempts to address corruption during the Suharto period and the early post-Suharto period. And also IMF conditionality that came in when the IMF provided a big bailout for the country in the late 1990s. The establishment of the Corruption Commission became a kind of condition for that for those bailouts. But as one person has described it, you know, this idea actually came from the local reformers themselves. But they'd never sort of been able to establish it. Now it's, you know, the KPK is well established. It's described as one of the few islands of integrity in the Indonesia justice system after the arrest of the Constitutional Court, which had begun to develop not under the current Chief Justice, who was only appointed a few months ago, but under the previous Chief Justice. It had develop a name as a strong institution that wasn't corrupt, but doesn't seem to be the case anymore. So the KPK is sort of independent from political institutions. It has powers to conduct wiretap operations without court approval. Its commissioners are not easily dismissed. And this has kind of created an opportunity to really build a strong organization that's properly resourced from the state budget. Its staff receive market salaries. It's able to recruit sort of the brightest and most committed staff. It has a strong sort of internal disciplinary mechanisms. So its budget is like $50-60 million a year. It has about $100,000 per case to cover its operational costs per case. It has a special dispensation from the Ministry of Administrative Reform that enables it to pay market salaries to its staff. When it first recruited, it had 12,000 applicants for 100 positions, and a big part of it was of the recruitment process was selecting people that were sort of intrinsically motivated. So in sum, you know, the KPK enforces corruption laws in high-profile cases because of political leadership, institutional incentives within the organisation, strong sort of organisational norms. There's also a lot of sort of induction of staff that takes place. I was going to tell you an anecdote about someone but I'll skip that. So let's just contrast this quickly with the standard criminal justice system, which has produced far more corruption prosecutions. In this case, the police and prosecutors are not independent of political institutions. They rely on the president, governors must approve corruption investigations. The police and prosecution are also not funded from the state. The official budget for the state, not fully funded from the state. The official the budget from the state is for the state prosecutors is about 100 million, of which about 5% is allocated to the corruption unit. But in reality, these funds are very highly fungible and sort of moved around internally within the organisation. Insiders that I've interviewed indicate that about only about 30% on average of a corruption case is covered official by the official budget, and the rest of it is covered by funds that the institution covers itself, raises itself through various means, including extortion, taking bribes in other cases, and using it to subsidise cases that receive result in sort of public outrage or are politically expedient. The staff receive woefully low salaries. A prosecutor, for example, would probably be starting on about $200 a month. This is someone who has a law degree, in contrast to the $2,000 or $3,000 at the Corruption Eradication Commission. Recruitment often requires either personal connections or payments. And there are examples of sort of hotshot lawyers in Jakarta sponsoring students all the way through law school until they rise to prominent positions in the justice institutions, and they become their sort of insiders that make sure their cases are kind of work through the system quicker and facilitate access to judges and stuff. Patronage dominates internal promotions and accountability mechanisms. District police chiefs, for example, pay as much as $30,000 for a two-year stint in a district with sort of a moderately wealthy district. And as the possibility for rent extraction increases, the amount goes up. So I sort of characterise this standard criminal justice system in Indonesia as a privatised public law enforcement regime. But at the same time, it's delivering corruption prosecutions. I mean, look at the number there, and it's increasing. I've got a chart where it goes back into the 1990s, and there's even where there's far fewer. But I think the way in which it's achieving this is because of an increase in demand, whereas the KPK is achieving its cases because of an increase sort of improvements in the supply of law enforcement. Democratization and increase in political competition has created incentives for opposition politicians to use law enforcement to unseat incumbents, for example. And the removal and restrictions of the press and civil society has helped to coordinate public demand for law enforcement for sort of smaller in cases. So I was going to elaborate a little bit on that, but I think we're running a bit short of time, so I'll move quickly through to the end. I guess the point I was going to make with the start with the slide and then talking a little bit about how these institutions function is that an indicator can be an imprecise way of capturing the performance of an institution, and for also understanding how it works. It doesn't really tell you also very much about how you can actually work with an institution. If donors and the international community want to work with KPK, or they want to work within the standard criminal justice system, I think it requires very different strategies. So just to sort of try and attempt to bring this up to the back up to the level of the high level panel, way above my level. I'll just sort of talk about some positives and negatives. I think, like Michael, I welcome the elevation of sort of governance issues, including corruption and judicial reform, to the top of the global development agenda, along with a lot of these other things. And second, I also welcome the high-level panel's emphasis on enforcement institution rather than an emphasis on using international legal agreements, for example, to sort of normalise corruption and legislation across the world. Although I noticed in some of the preliminary indicators that you've snuck out of New York that some of this has kind of crept back in, that we need to kind of reform legislation. I mean, I don't think it's going to make any difference, very little difference in Indonesia, particularly to the standard criminal justice system. If you change the laws, focus on the enforcement institutions is going to be much more better use of resources. The high-level panel's suggestion for... I'll just jump over that. But one of the things that the report talks about is sort of a regular high-level political panel at the international level. And I think that could potentially help national reformers achieve their agenda, although like it did in the terms of the IMF, the way the IMF in Indonesia worked with local reformers is to establish the Corruption Eradication Commission. Although I think that's, Indonesia's basically on its knees begging for a bailout. This type of forum will have the ability to make such strong demands. But I think some of the negatives or the things I like less include, I think Michael's touched on this, is the report's emphasis on quantitative statistics, also complete emphasis on quantitative statistics. I think they mask a lot of, I think there's a lot of other information that the development community needs if they want to make an assessment about whether progress is being made in these countries. Also, I think there's a potential for indicators to be abused. Quotas have been introduced in Indonesia, but they often have led to sort of law enforcement agencies actually going out looking for easy to prosecute cases, particularly acute cases involving communities where the community may have already resolved the case, and sort of use social norms and social sanctions as a form of punishment. And then the law enforcement think, oh, that's an easy case I can sort of meet my quota with, so they go and reopen this case and sort of undermine the community process. I'll just leave it there, I guess.
All right. Well, thank you very much.